Before we start this episode of Conversations with Kenyatta, I'm excited to tell you about my new partnership with Audible. Listeners can go to www.audibletrial.com/Kenyatta to receive a free 30-day trial. Audible is a wonderful resource with audiobooks for every reader. It even has titles from authors that have been on my podcast, such as Dr. Dan Bouck's Democracy's Data and Gail Lukasik's White Like Her. And please note that this is an affiliate link, so I may receive a commission with no cost to you, just a free trial with so many wonderful titles. And I love to read. But with that, here's this week's episode of Conversations with Kenyatta. Welcome to episode 14 of Conversations with Kenyatta. Today, I'm joined by my friend, James R. Morgan III. He's a historian, genealogist, and author. And today, we'll discuss his recent book, The Lost Empire, Black Freemasonry in the Old West, 1867 to 1906. Welcome, James. I've known you for quite some time, but for our listeners, when did you become interested in genealogy?
I initially became interested in genealogy, I would say when I was a child, to some extent. We can talk about that a little bit later. But, you know, I've always been very close to my family. I came from a really big extended family, and it was kind of a unique situation because I didn't really grow up with a lot of relatives who were my age or even my age bracket. So when I was a child, almost everybody was older than me until my brother came along later. But some of my earliest memories are just being around a lot of elders in my family. I really got serious about studying genealogy, I would say, in college. And essentially what happened, I'm originally from New Jersey. I moved to D.C. and attended the illustrious Howard University. And I had an assignment from one of my professors, Dr. Charles Johnson, who happens to be a member of OGS. And he gives this assignment every year where what he does is he asks students to research their family history and come back and talk about how some aspect of a bigger movement or historical moment, how did it affect your family directly? So it could be the Great Depression, the Civil War, the Great Migration, whatever it was, it had to, you know, how did that big idea, that big moment affect your family specifically? And at first, you know, I said, well, don't nobody care about my family. You know, I just come from I just come from regular old black folk from Alabama. Who cares, right? But I remembered this story that my grandfather had told me when I was 6 years old. To make a long story short, my grandmother had three children by three different men. My grandfather, she grew up with my grandfather, and so therefore my mother is the oldest. And my mother was the last one to have children, being the oldest. And so I'd never forget, I was 6 years old. My grandmother woke me up, and I used to go to Alabama every summer and be with her. She woke me up, told me I was going to spend the day with my grandfather, and me being me, I'm thinking I'm going to, you know, Waterworld, which is this theme park they have down there, or, you know, to the toy store or something. My grandfather, God bless him, he took me to the cemetery and showed me where his side of my family, where they were buried and whatnot. And I come to understand that my grandfather came from a pretty prominent black family in the southeastern Alabama region. And then he took me to church. He took me to this church called Cherry Street African Methodist Episcopal Church, and he sat me down and told me the story of Reverend W.J. Hightower, who was my great-great-great-grandfather. The story he told me was that Reverend Hightower had come to the city of Dothan, which is where my family essentially was from, and Reverend Hightower decided he wanted to build a new church. He raised money, went to the brick factory in town. There was only one brick factory in that whole area at the time, and we're talking about the early 1900s. And the man who owned the brick factory refused to sell him a single brick. So what Reverend Hightower did was he organized the black community, people from other Christian denominations, I'm sure, what have you. And essentially the community came together and they started getting bricks from all over town, from abandoned buildings, construction sites. I'm quite sure that some bricks were liberated from the brick factory as well. And when he got enough bricks to build, he built this church. And the church still is standing today. It's the oldest continually standing religious edifice in the city of Dothan. It is considered the mother AME church for the state of Alabama as well. And at 6 years old, my grandfather is telling me this story, and I'm sitting there looking at this cornerstone with Reverend W.J. Hightower's name emblazoned on it. So flash forward back to my time at Howard, that was the one story that I could think of in my family history that I thought would be interesting for class. And to be honest with you, I did enough to turn the assignment in and pass, and I passed the class. But I, at this point, you know, in my early 20s, I was becoming a budding researcher in my own right. Genealogy wasn't necessarily my focus, but I knew, I said, well, wait a minute. I still had a lot of questions about Reverend Hightower's life. And I personally wasn't satisfied. I had satisfied the course requirement or what have you, but I was not personally satisfied with the level of knowledge that I had, or really the lack of knowledge that I had at that time. And so that, you know, next thing I know, I'm subscribing to Ancestry beyond the 2-week free trial and everything. And from there, it just became an addiction. And here we are all these years later.
And it is an addiction. I mean, I totally understand that. It's actually an obsession, yes. Going down rabbit holes and, you know, researching and different things like that. And it's a fascinating story. And I know we'll talk about that a little bit later as well. So what are some of the challenges? I mean, you had such a great experience with your grandfather, although it was, you thought you were going to Waterworld, but she went to the cemetery. Right. That was still a wonderful experience for him just to pass that on. And, you know, 20 plus years later, you still remember that story and you were able to share it with your class. But in doing your research on your family, following up on that curiosity, what challenges have you encountered in doing your genealogy?
I would say some of the challenges that I encountered were pretty typical for genealogists, or from African-American genealogists in particular. But I had a lot of blessings as well. And by that, I mean, there's a lot of things that I kind of have taken for granted at a younger age, as far as my knowledge of my family history, that I've come to realize a lot of people didn't have. So, and what I mean by that specifically is I got to meet 4 of my great grandparents. My great grandfather, Professor Wallace L. Smith Jr., passed away in July 29th of 2020. So I got to live the first 30 years of my life with my great grandfather still being on the earth and still being able to talk to him and interview him. And I always, whenever I bring him up, I always try to encourage people, if you have elders in your family, take the time today to record them and talk to them. Don't wait until next week or next month, because you just never know. And I mean, I did a video interview with my granddaddy 7 years to the day before he passed.
Wow.
7 years to the day before he passed, you know, and so being able to have access to that, and I got to meet a number of great aunts as well. So I was very blessed in that regard. But to answer your question about the challenges, some of the challenges that I faced were just not knowing where to start initially. It took me some time to really get more involved in terms of the genealogy community, as far as like joining OGS and going to NGS and Roots Tech and all that. That stuff people kind of know me for now came later. Initially, it was just, you know, trying to figure out where to begin. Looking at the census, you know, that whole chestnut, talking to my elders, getting people to be willing to talk to me, especially as I started getting deeper into my family history. I'm very bold. Look, you could be my 9th cousin twice removed. If I find you on Facebook or Twitter, I'm sending you a direct message. And so getting people to talk to me and to understand, you know, who I am and what I'm about. And I'm not, you know, no, I'm not, this is not a scam. I'm not trying to get any money from you unless you're my rich uncle I've been looking for. I really just want to find out about my family history. That's been one of the biggest roadblocks for me. The last thing I would say as well would be really trying to dive into the history of slavery in my family. Mm-hmm. At first was a major challenge. I almost sometimes forget how challenging it was now because of, you know, time has passed. But really, I mean, I just remember when I started doing genealogy, I am a spiritual person, and I believe in prayer, and I don't pray often, but when I do pray, it's I'm really praying for something. And I prayed that I could find the names of enslaved ancestors of mine. Growing up, I knew none. I prayed I could find the names of some enslaved ancestors of mine, as well as I prayed that I could find at least one photograph. And here we are years later, and I found multiple names, and I have multiple photographs and multiple stories and multiple probate records and things. And so, you know, I say that to say, you know, time, patience, and perseverance do accomplish all things.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Yeah, I've had similar challenges, but I really like how you frame that as far as getting started and the things that you learned over time. But in doing this and becoming, you know, obsessed and addicted to genealogy, what made you decide to become a professional genealogist? Why did you choose this as your path?
Well, for me, it was because I really get a joy out of helping people. I believe that if you have the ability to help others, especially if you have knowledge that can help others, that it becomes your duty to do that. And I, you know, the more I started, you know, posting on Facebook and doing things of that nature, it just became very apparent to me that it was something I was good at, something that I enjoy doing. And then I'll be honest with you, and I'm not just saying this because I'm on your platform, and being able to watch people like yourself as well definitely was an inspiration to be able to say, hey, you know, there's people out here who are actually not only helping people, but making an income, whether it be a secondary or third income or a primary income. That has been a big inspiration for me. And not being at this time, you know, in my 20s, you know, I graduated college. Now I'm out in the working world, but I still always wanted to have that academic, intellectual, you know, edge to me. That's something I've always been into. And as we're recording, as you know, today is literally my first day of graduate school. So I'm recording for the audience. I'm actually recording live from Morgan State University, my new academic home. And so it, you know, it's really been a pleasure to be able to help others. Eventually I decided that I, when I learned about Black ProGen Live, which is a YouTube program that I've been on for a number of years, I contacted Nika Soul Smith and just, you know, just said, hey, if you ever need help, you know, I'd be interested. Here we are a bunch of seasons later, and it really became, like you said, an addiction. It's an obsession, but I also feel it's a duty if you're able to help others.
So let's just talk about what is Black ProGen Live? Kind of what's the program about?
Sure. So Black ProGen Live, we are one of the top YouTube-based shows for people of color genealogy. Mm-hmm. We've done episodes on everything from state-based research to Freedmen's Bureau records, understanding religious and fraternal life of people of African descent. We've branched out a little bit. We've talked about researching relatives with our ancestors with Southeast Asian and Pacific Islander ancestry as well. Pretty much just about any topic you can think of, we've touched it or tried to touch it as much as possible on the show and whatnot. And so that show ran for a number of seasons. And it was myself, Nika Soul Smith, Dr. Shelley Murphy, who I believe you've already had on here, Angela Walton Raji, Teresa Vega, and a number of others. We had a number of excellent discussions, and I'm very proud to have been a part of that program.
So you are active Prince Hall Freemason.
Yes.
So who was Prince Hall, and what does it mean to be a Prince Hall Freemason?
Sure. So Prince Hall, we don't know a ton about his personal life, but I will tell you what we do know. Prince Hall was a man of Africa. He was a Black man who was alive, born sometime around 1735 or so. He was most likely formerly enslaved by a man named William Hall. And he becomes free a few years prior to the American Revolution. He was an abolitionist. He was an educator. He actually opened up a school for Black children out of his home in Boston, Massachusetts. And he was very active in the community. One of the things that he decides to do is he, along with 14 other men of African descent, they decide that they want to join the fraternity of Freemasons or Freemasonry, which had been established, our traditional history says, established in London in 1717. Now, at this time, Freemasonry is considered a gentleman's philosophical fraternity. That's the kind of the best way I could describe it. In Masonry, you have to believe in God. That's number one. You have to, that doesn't put a specific religion on it, but you know, you have to be a person who believes in a higher power. And the fraternity teaches things like equality among all men, you know, how to be a gentleman, you know, being morally upright. You know, all these different philosophies. A number of the founders of the United States were not just Freemasons, but very active and involved, such as George Washington, probably being the number one people can think of. Benjamin Franklin actually at one time was Grand Master of the Masons of Pennsylvania. Okay, so I think it was about 14 or 15 signers of the Declaration of Independence in the Constitution were Masons. Samuel Adams as well. What happens is that eventually Prince Hall decides to join this organization, and he petitions the Grand Lodge of England, the oldest Grand Lodge in the world, for a charter, which was granted to him in September of 1784 to establish African Lodge number 459. The problem is, 1784, what are relations between America and England in the 1780s, right? So America is becoming an independent nation. Prince Hall has this charter from the Grand Lodge of England, But the American grand lodges are starting to become form independent grand lodges, just as the states are becoming an independent nation. So you would think that African Lodge, when the Grand Lodge of Massachusetts is formed, you would think that African Lodge would get invited because they were in Massachusetts, right? Wrong. Of all the lodges that were in the state of Massachusetts at the time, wouldn't you know African Lodge is the only one that wasn't invited to that? And over time, Prince Hall and the brothers, it became very apparent that the dominant, you know, white Masonic lodges, and by dominant, I just mean in terms of number, population, they had no intention of fully recognizing black men as Masons, even though they had taken the same obligations, paid money to the same people, et cetera, et cetera. That became very apparent. And so over time, what you have happen is that African Lodge metastasizes, first with a second African Lodge in the city of Philadelphia, which was headed by Reverend Absalom Jones and Bishop Richard Allen, okay? Then to New York, then my home state, New Jersey, it comes down to D.C. And before you know it, just as in many other aspects of American life, you have one fraternity that was split along the color line and ends up forming two different histories. So to be a Freemason is to be a man who is a member of the Masonic order, and what have you. But to be a Prince Hall Freemason, which we are historically and majority of our membership is of African descent, to be a Prince Hall Mason is a very, very unique history, which as a genealogist, taking you back to our discussion, right? As a family historian, for me, I started realizing very early on that this was a very unique history, very unique data set that a lot of genealogists were not looking at. And so as I got more involved in the organization and became more involved in studying the history of it, and as well as genealogy, those two interests kind of were happening at the same time for me. And I'll just be honest with you, I do not like having two or three separate interests. I like whatever I'm interested in, I like to merge everything together. and so eventually, when I would go on Facebook or different platforms and people would post pictures of their ancestor and say, oh, this is my ancestor, he was this and he was that, she was this, she was that, I would find myself either correcting them, or more often than not, people wouldn't know anything about it and they had questions but didn't know who to turn to. And so eventually, I kind of just became the person, one of those people that people would, you know, would tag and say, hey, James knows about that stuff. Go ask him. And even if I didn't know about it, I realized very quickly I had to learn. I had to figure it out to be able to help others.
Yeah, that's one of the things that was interesting to me, because I didn't know anything about it myself. I really haven't done a lot of research. And it is very niche. I mean, it's very unique, right, to be a part of that history. Are there any resources that are available for people online, or, you know, in print, if they find out that their person was part of one of these organizations,
absolutely,
Masons, or I've seen some of the other fraternal organizations too.
Yeah, absolutely. So for Masonry and the Order of the Eastern Star, which is our kind of our female appendage, probably the number one place I recommend people to check out would be the Iowa Masonic Library. The Iowa Masonic Library houses the largest collection of Masonic and fraternal archives in the country. Another great location to contact would be the Livingston Library in New York. It's the Robert Livingston Library in New York, under the Grand Lodge of New York. The Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, of course, is a go-to. If you're in Louisiana, I highly encourage that you reach out to the Amistad Research Facility, because the Prince Hall Grand Lodge, for the audience, when I say Prince Hall Grand Lodge, that's the historically African-American Grand Lodge system that I'm a member of. Prince Hall Grand Lodge of Louisiana has a wonderful archive at Amistad. I would be remiss if I did not mention the fact that Prince Hall Grand Lodge of D.C., where I'm the grand historian, we have an archive at Howard University's Moreland Spingarn Research Center. And in order to get access to that, you have to get in contact with the grand historian. That's me. I'm more than happy to, I don't deny requests. I'm more than happy to work with anybody who's researching that. Another great resource, and this is something that people can do today. If you have newspapers.com or Genealogy Bank subscriptions, people don't realize just how important and influential fraternal organizations were. I would say during the golden age of American fraternalism, which is considered to be from the end of the Civil War to the Great Depression, when for scholars of this history, what we would define as the golden age of fraternalism. So during that period, it was very common, especially in the Black community, to and for have a family of people who are in multiple organizations in just one nuclear family. Mom and dad might be, you know, on Monday night, Mason meeting. Tuesday night, mom is at the Eastern Star meeting. Wednesday night, the Oddfellows. Thursday is the Sisters of the Mysterious Ten. You know, Friday is, the Elks. You know, Saturday night, Saturday is the ball and social function. Then Sunday, everybody's meeting. Right? Everybody's meeting. I mean, that was kind of what was going on at this time. And there's definitely the more esoteric kind of, you know, we talk about rituals and secret handshakes and, you know, all that stuff. But there's also a more practical side to this history as well, as a lot of folks don't think about. You're talking about a time period before the Affordable Care Act. You're talking about a time period before the major insurance industry as we kind of know it today comes into play. And so what am I talking about? This is how a lot of us had what we today would call insurance. And one of the reasons why a lot of our families would be members of multiple organizations is because of the fact that you had one organization might offer dental insurance for your members. Another organization had burial insurance. If you paid your dues up to a certain point, we made sure you had a headstone. Another group had might have a doctor or a group of doctors that were in network. We've heard the term in network, right? But we think about where it comes from. That's what they mean by that. That was the original meaning of having a physician in the network, meaning that they were actually a part of the organization. And if you went to a doctor who was one of our members, you got a special rate versus going to a doctor out of network, right? So up until the Great Depression, this is how a lot of Americans actually were able to provide those services to their family. There's no workman's comp in, you know, 1882. So if you lost a hand at the sawmill, you lost a hand at the sawmill, unless you were a member of one of these organizations that might have some money for you. And so that's something that a lot of folks don't think about, but it's something that I thought about and continue to think about as I'm doing this history, this research. And I've just been overjoyed at being able to help others to kind of understand it.
Those are excellent points. I mean, I've seen packets. I had a client, I think I even reached out to you. I had a client who had an ancestor in a fraternal organization, and they had like a life insurance policy, right? And that was part of the person's pension file.
Yep.
From the National Archives, right? So seeing those records, that was new to me. I haven't done a lot of research in this area, but I find it fascinating just listening to you talk about the benefits. It's not just, you know, it's part of the community. These organizations serve the community.
Yes, absolutely.
And the records that are available and the resources at all the locations that you named. But I want to switch gears a little bit, and I want to talk about your book.
Sure. Before you ask that question, let me say one thing I almost forgot to mention. For anyone who has access to newspapers.com, Genealogy Bank, archives.org, anything of that nature with newspapers, I really challenge you to look at the newspapers that you're already using and look at the fraternal columns. A lot of times, especially in Black newspapers, they would actually list out, not so common today, but back then, when you start talking about before, I would say World War II, World War I, it was very common that they would say, oh, the Eastern Stars had an election and Sister Kenyatta Berry is now the new secretary. Please send your dues to her address here, or what have you. That was very commonplace in American life, and particularly in African-American life during that period. So you can contact those institutions that I listed earlier, but also just look at the newspapers and you'd be surprised at some of the things that may be sitting right under your nose.
Thank you for mentioning that, because I love newspapers. I have seen that information, those elections, and not for fraternal organizations, but even within my family, you know, some local community society or group that they have. It helps you kind of tell the story of your ancestor, right? We see names, dates, and places, but with this type of information, we can now kind of visualize what their life was like at that time. Definitely. Absolutely. So let's get to your book, because I'm excited for you to talk about it. So I have to make sure I get all your awards right. So you wrote the award-winning book, The Lost Empire, Black Freemasonry in the Old West from 1867 to 1906. And it was published in 2018. Now, before we get to talking about the book, I want to mention an award. The Lost Empire won the Dr. Charles H. Wesley Medal of History, which is the highest honor given to historical works. And tell me the society's name. I'm going to butcher. Phylaxis Society. I was like, I'm not going to even try that without you saying it first. So what is this society? And tell us a little bit more about this award.
Sure. So the Phylaxis Society is an organization that was established in 1973 by the late Joseph A. Walks Jr. The society was created really as the word phylaxis, my understanding, is Greek, and it means the defenders or to defend something. Joseph Walks came up with this idea because in white Freemasonry or international Freemasonry around the world, there are a number of research organizations that deal with the history, philosophy, ritual, etc. of Freemasonry, that whole culture. It's like a whole subculture of that. At the time, there really had not been a successful Black research organization that focused on the history and contributions of African Americans or people of African descent at all to the Masonic and fraternal world. Joseph Walks, much in the kind of similar to James Dent Walker, the story about how he got OGG started. Joseph Walks decided to join a prominent all-white research organization, and everything was fine until they realized he was Black, and then they put him out. And so he decided to start his own research organization. The Phylaxis has been running strong since then. We have a quarterly magazine conference and offer, you know, awards and prizes for writing, not just by our members, but even for students as well. For children, we offer scholarships and other things. And so it's a really great organization to be a part of, especially if you're into this type of history, and to be given the award named after Dr. Charles Wesley, who was formerly, who used to teach at Howard University, who also was a member of one of the lodges here in D.C., not the one that I'm a part of, but another one. That was a supreme honor for me, and I'm very thankful to have been awarded that.
That's great. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And now last year in 2020, the Lost Empire received the Phyllis Wheatley Book Award for nonfiction biography, and that was from the Sons and Daughters of the U.S. Middle Passage Lineage Society.
Yes.
The Sons and Daughters of the U.S. Middle Passage Lineage Society, I'm actually going to have LaBrenda on the podcast, so we'll probably talk about that in a little bit more detail, so we won't get into that here. But I want you to get more into what your book is about. What's the premise of The Lost Empire?
Sure. So there's a sub story of how the book came to be, just like any book, as I'm sure you know. In May of 2014, I was contacted by a woman named Denisha Swanigan, who lives out in Missouri, and she had two pieces of paper that changed my life forever. The first one she had was a letter written from one of her great uncles, whose name was J.J. Bruce, to her other great uncle, Senator Blanche Kelso Bruce.
Oh.
So for those who do not know, Senator Bruce was the first African-American to serve a full term in the United States Congress, following behind Senator and Reverend Hiram Rhodes Revels. All three of these men were Prince Hall Masons. J.J. Bruce wrote this letter, and it really didn't have any major historical content. It was essentially a letter congratulating the senator on his recent wedding to his wife, Josephine, which I found out when he moves to D.C., he meets his wife, falls madly in love. They're in such a rush to get married that he forgets to invite his own mother, his own family, to the wedding. They found out in the newspaper that he got married.
Wow.
And so, yeah, and so this letter was basically his brother saying, congratulations, I'm writing you on behalf of our mother, and we want to know who the heck is this woman that you just brought into the family, right? But I guess it was okay because Josephine came from a pretty wealthy family. So I guess they got over it really quickly. I know I would. And so, but the letter was written on Masonic Lodge, Grand Lodge letterhead. And the Grand Lodge whose letterhead it was, is today known as the Prince Hall Grand Lodge of Missouri. At that time, and we're talking now, the letter was dated, I think, 1870 or 1868. I can't remember right now, but to make a long story short, the name of the Grand Lodge at that time was different than what it is today. And so Ms. Swanigan was trying to understand, who the heck are you Masons? What is this about? And so I basically was explaining it to her. Then she gave me another document that she had in her collection that really became the seed for the book. Mm-hmm. And it was from 1869. And it talked about how another one of her uncles, whose name was Henry Bruce, he had been shot in Leavenworth, Kansas. And what happened was that the assailant, whose real name was Alan Pinks, had been captured, was taken to court. He could not make bail. And on his way back to his holding cell, a group of 10, between 10 and 12 black men rode up on horseback, surrounded the party, and gunned him down in broad daylight in front of the sheriff and rode off into the sunset. And the newspaper specifically stated that the leader of this group was a man by the name of Captain William D. Matthews, who the newspaper, they said he was the highest muckamuck. That's the word they used among the colored Masons in the state. And they specifically stated that this shooting was instigated by the colored Masonic fraternity of Leavenworth, Kansas, at the behest of Captain Matthews. And when I read this, I said, what in the world is going on in Kansas? So I took this story to other historians that I thought would know, you know, who could help me, to help Miss Swanigan to understand what was happening here. And none of them could help me. I was really frustrated. I mean, these are people, some, one of them in particular has published a number of books and everything. And I said, well, somebody's got to know something about this. And nobody can help tell me almost anything except for the fact that William D. Matthews was pretty much, he was a known figure at that time in our organization, but not for this particular story. We can get into this in a moment. But for this particular story, no one really knew about this. And so I started looking at different books and published accounts. And then I started doing my own research and looking at newspapers and other primary sources. And it became very apparent to me very quickly that the published history of Black Freemasonry in Kansas, and as I would come to find in the, basically what we now today know as the Wild West, was entirely incorrect. The published accounts were wrong. And the stuff that I was finding, which was from that time period, seemed to actually be more correct than the, what was in the books. Mm-hmm. And so this started off as an article, which became a research paper, which eventually became my first book. And I mean, Captain Matthews was one heck of a guy. He lived multiple lives. Just to give you a basic rundown of him, he was the organizer of the 1st Kansas Colored Volunteer Regiment, which became the 79th United States Colored Troops. He was originally from Maryland, had moved out to Kansas. And he was an abolitionist, worked the Underground Railroad. He worked with John Brown at one point. And the thing about Captain Matthews is, I mean, I don't know any other way to say it, but I mean, this guy was like, I mean, he almost comes out of Hollywood casting. I mean, he was a gunslinger. He was a soldier. I mean, he, you know, he, I mean, it was, I mean, the things this guy did, I mean, even the stuff I didn't agree with was just like legendary. It was like we need to get a movie on this guy. I mean, it's almost, I think when I think of a lot of figures from the 19th century, it's almost amazing to think like this was all one guy, you know. Mm-hmm. And a lot of his history as far as within the fraternity had been covered up or ignored because of some other internal politics, which we may or may not get into today. But his story was just so fascinating. And to go back to this shooting for a second, I mean, they shot Alan Pinks in front of the sheriff in broad daylight and got away with it. Mm. I mean, you can't get 10 to 12 black men to do that now and get away with it. But right. He was able to do that. And there's other instances of that. I mean, this guy was literally like out of Hollywood casting. And so the book essentially became a history of Black Freemasonry in Kansas. And he established what was known as the King Solomon Grand Lodge of Kansas, which while it was based in that state, eventually was spread out to have lodges in Nebraska and down to Arkansas, into Oklahoma and Indian Territory, Colorado, Texas. And I mean, the story of this guy's life, it's so, just been so fascinating that the book essentially is a history of Freemasonry in that region, but also a biography of him, because he was just an amazing figure. Even the things I disagree with him on, he was amazing at it.
Yeah, I mean, that's fascinating and shocking all at the same time that he was able to get away with that. But when you were doing your research, mm-hmm. did you come across or were you in contact with any of his descendants as you started to?
Yes.
Okay. And how did they feel about it? Were they open to you actually researching their ancestor and then sharing this information with them?
Well, you know, to this day, I almost wish somebody would call me about, would do this, like contact me and tell me about my ancestor to this degree, because I have not been able to find any direct descendants of his, but I have been able to contact some great nieces and nephews. And I found out that one of Captain Matthews, he had a brother-in-law, was it William Carney, I believe, who was one of the black men to win the Medal of Honor during the Civil War. Mm-hmm. So I was able to contact people from that side. And what I found out was that the primary researcher in that family, they thought that their uncle William Matthews had died young because they couldn't find him in the census beyond when he was 16 years old.
Oh wow!
You know, he was born free in 1827 in Eastern Shore of Maryland. So he appears as a child, but then after the age of 16, he disappears from the records in Maryland. And the reason why that is because when he hit the age of 20, he decided to leave Maryland. He actually lived in Jamaica for 2 years and worked as he ended up getting his own boat, worked as a fisherman, and he shipped rice and grain up and down the East Coast. And then when the state of Maryland passed a law forbidding black men to own seafaring or seaworthy vessels, he was forced by law to sell his ship. And then he was asked by a man named Daniel Reed Anthony, who, if you haven't heard of Daniel Reed Anthony, that's okay. But Daniel Reed Anthony had a younger sister named Susan B. Anthony. Mm. Daniel Reed Anthony asked Matthews to come out to Leavenworth. And he said he figured he would have a better time out there trying to make his living. And so he leaves Maryland forever and basically goes to Kansas. And so when I contacted his family, and I'm like, hey, like, no, he didn't die. He went to Jamaica, and then he became a grandmaster of the Masons, and he was a gunslinger, and he was this. I mean, the lady, his great niece that I've contacted with, her name is Renee. I just remember hearing her on the phone, and she was like, I know she thought I was nuts. She was like, who are you? I'm like, miss, don't hang the phone up. I'm telling you, like, I need to talk to you. Like, your uncle was an action hero. He was, like, legendary. But they've been very thankful and receptive to it. And they, you know, when I started giving pictures, and the funny thing is, when I the first time I emailed them a picture of him, because there are multiple photographs of him, she looked and said, oh my God, it looks like my grandfather. Oh my God. Like, they could see the family resemblance, which was crazy. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, this is exciting. I mean, I love that, you know, that you did this work, your focus, you uncovered this, you know, person that could be in a movie, an movie, so to speak. But I wanted to kind of take a step back. And I know we've been talking, you know, before about kind of community involvement locally as it relates to preserving African-American history, right? Because you writing this book, The Lost Empire, you being, you know, the work you do with Prince Hall Freemasons and making sure this story is told. There was recently a big announcement in the community where you live in Maryland around a cemetery. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. So as I was saying earlier, I do serve as the grand historian for the Prince Hall Grand Lodge of D.C., where our Grand Master is Quincy Gant, and Grand Master Gant has been very supportive of my efforts as grand historian. One of the things that I do is I try to make sure that we're relevant as an organization in the genealogy space, but also kind of in the, I would say, the community activism and scholarly space as well. And so because one of the reasons why is because I don't like the idea of us as an organization being ignored, because sometimes when we're ignored, not only does that mean that people aren't thinking about us, but also means people aren't using the resources we have in terms of records and other information that we may have access to, which is not something I want. And so I said all that to say that in June 6th of 1825, our first lodge in D.C., Social Lodge Number 1, was established. In November of that year, the same exact men who established this lodge established a burial arm for the lodge called the Columbian Burial Society. And they established one of the first black cemeteries in the nation's capital called Harmony Cemetery. That cemetery became the final resting place for some of the most prominent and affluent African-Americans in this nation's history, as well as for a number of everyday average folks who were just as important to history, even if they're not as well documented. What ends up happening is that, in I believe it was about 1960 or so, the cemetery at its location on Rhode Island Avenue was sold. That space was sold in favor of a new space in Maryland. The contractor was supposed to move all of the bodies to the new location as well as all the headstones. Well, to my knowledge, at least some of the bodies got moved and the headstones disappeared until about 2008, I believe it was, when they were discovered. It was discovered that contractor had decided to use them as riprap to shore up like erosion down in Virginia in the Potomac River. So they were discovered on the land of a current Republican legislator in the state of Virginia, State Senator Stewart. And so you have 37,000 headstones of mostly African-Americans, some poor whites. And I found, or I won't say I found, but our group has found one headstone of a Japanese immigrant.
Wow.
Actually, Mr. Lee. Yeah, Mr. Lee, which I have seen. I have photos of Mr. Lee, who was a Japanese immigrant who had been buried there. These headstones were discarded as though they were trash and left in the water until they've been found. So I have, at the behest of my Grand Master and on behalf of our Grand Lodge, we have been in touch with a group called the Sons and Daughters of Harmony Cemetery, which is an initiative that has been established basically to memorialize this, to recover as many stones as are feasible so that they can be moved to a memorial park. And we're still kind of navigating how that's going to work. But there's a 1 acre memorial space has been set aside at the current Harmony Cemetery site to honor those cemetery inhabitants who had been disrespected in that way. And many of these men and women were the forefathers and foremothers for African-American Freemasonry, just for the Black community in general here in D.C. I mean, other prominent names such as Elizabeth Keckley, who was the seamstress to Mary Todd Lincoln. For those who've seen the Lincoln film by Steven Spielberg, she was the woman who was in the relationship with Thaddeus Stevens, Tommy Lee Jones's character in the film. And so, I mean, you have a number of others that were there. And so the idea that almost 40,000 people could be disrespected in that way in the heart of America's so-called democracy, it really churned my stomach. And so fortunately, we've been working with another organization. I got to make sure I shout out the HASAN, which is History, Arts, Science, Action Network. We've been all partnering together to bring attention to this. And so we're recording this on Wednesday. So this past Monday, we had a ceremony with Governor of Virginia, Governor Hogan from Maryland, and Mayor Muriel Bowser, where we've had an official handover of the stones from Virginia back to D.C., who's now turning them back over to Maryland so these stones can get some rest. And so I'm very honored to be one of the people on the team working on this project.
Thank you for sharing that and for sharing your involvement. I know you sent that article over, you know, prior to us talking today. And I do agree with you. It's very disrespectful and it's disheartening to know that your final resting place was, you know, even I can't even find the words to describe it, but it's just disheartening to know that occurred. And hopefully this memorial park and now a way in time, you know, to make this right again, I guess, is what I'm looking for, or the phrase.
Absolutely.
I'm looking
for. Absolutely. And if people want to get involved, I encourage you, or to learn more, I encourage you to check out projectharmonycemetery.com is our website. We are actively, and this one of the reasons why I really appreciate the HASAN organization for putting this together is because they're very intentional about getting the descendant community involved in this project. Many of the HASAN members are not necessarily a part of that community, but they're very adamant about having that community involvement. Again, I mean, you have the extended family of Frederick Douglass was affected by this. You know, obviously the Prince Hall, Grand Lodge, a lot of the Black churches in D.C. were affected by this. And so we are actively looking for descendants or people who are connected to this story. So if you think there's even a slight possibility that you have relatives who were graves were desecrated or who were at Harmony Cemetery, please do not hesitate to reach out to us, because we want to get photographs, we want stories, we want to flood every outlet we can with this information. So please make sure to contact us at projectharmonycemetery.com.
Right. Thanks for that. Yeah, I'm sure, and we'll also make sure we have links to that as well. So I want to wrap up our conversation. You know, you've done a lot. I mean, you're in grad school now, you've written your first book, you won several awards, you're working on this project you just mentioned. What's next for you? And are you working on another book?
Yes. So what's next for me right now is, as I mentioned earlier, I'm in my first day of grad school, so I'm getting adjusted with that. I am actually looking to write another book. And so my next one is going to be a little different than the first one. I want to do kind of a novel of the life of Reverend Hightower, because of all my ancestors, Reverend Hightower is definitely one. Not there's others, but Reverend Hightower is definitely one that his story just continues to fascinate me. I found so much documentation on him, and the more I look at him, I'm like, I don't physically look like him, but his spirit. Like, he's always doing something. Like you said, like, I'm always up to something. It's like Reverend Hightower was always doing something, you know? And so, I mean, he was a trustee. Part of the reason why, I'll be honest with you, why I just decided to go back to school was because I found out that by the age of 36, Reverend Hightower was a trustee of Payne University, which was doesn't exist anymore, but it was an HBCU in Alabama at the time. And so I'm like, wow, he was 36 and he was a trustee. I turned 32 next month and I don't even have a master's degree yet. Let me go ahead and get my act together, you know? So I want to do a novelization of his life and just continue to spread the word and do the good work that we're supposed to be doing.
Well, yeah, you have your hands full with grad school, and also, and again, congratulations on that and all your success you've had. But then, and writing a book and stretching yourself to go from nonfiction to a novel is a big jump. Good luck with that. I don't know if I'm ready to make that leap, but I trust me,
I don't plan on being a novelist. I think this might be the one and only, but we'll see.
Yeah, because I'm like, ooh, that's so different. But I really enjoyed our conversation today. I've learned so much from you today, really. And I do have a lot of newspaper clippings with my family, and I've seen some of these fraternal organizations for extended family members, mm-hmm. and I glide right over them. So now I'm going to go back and take your suggestion, looking at the newspaper articles, seeing what else is in the paper of the clips that I have related to these organizations, and definitely make sure I would encourage everyone, if there's any particular, especially cemeteries, because we have this happen a lot with Black cemeteries, where either buildings are, you know, they basically just put a strip mall or a grocery store or anything over the cemetery with no.
Which is exactly what happened to Harmony. There's a Home Depot there right now, yeah, and a train station.
Yeah, exactly. So that happens. I mean, you know, it happened in Washington County, Virginia years ago, and I only found out about that from a project I was working on the past couple of years. So these things happen all the time, and just really get involved because you want to preserve these legacies. And this is a great place to start, I think, with ProjectHarmonyCemetery.com to see what they're doing. And maybe you can do the same in your community. So, James, thank you so much. So much.
Thank you. And if I can just say, you know, I have to give you your flowers while you're here to smell them. I'm so thankful to you, Kenyatta, for all your friendship and your mentorship and everything else in between. You know, I studied you from afar, like many people, in your time on television and everything. And you and I happened to meet one day at a hotel, and we've been attached at the hip ever since. And so I'm just really proud of you and honored that you would want to have a conversation with me today. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. We met at the OGS conference. And for those that don't know what OGS is, we mentioned that a lot, it's the Afro-American Historical and Genealogical Society, founded by James Dent. So thank you again, and enjoy the rest of your classes today.
Will do.
Whatever you have to do.
Conversations with Kenyatta is produced by Kenyatta D. Berry and Caitlin Owl, and features Kenyatta D. Berry. The music for this episode was Good Vibe by Ketza. Follow Kenyatta on Instagram under the handle kenyatta.berry, on Facebook at facebook.com/kenyattadb, and on Twitter at kenyattadb. You can also find more information on her book and upcoming events on her website at kenyattaberry.com.